Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the move to an online casino in Gary. Brandon Smith reports on the 2017 anti-abortion law remaining blocked. Sharon Jackson speaks with Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson about the theft charges against a former Genesis Center bookkeeper. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Northwest Indiana activist Ruth Needleman. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The husband of a late Indiana legislator has been convicted of murder in the 2018 shooting death of a Northwest Indiana attorney. A late criminal court jury returned the verdict Wednesday in the case against William Lansky, widower of the late Republican State Senator Sue Lansky of Cedar Lake. The 84-year-old faces about 40 to 60 years in prison when sentenced October 3rd for the death of 64-year-old T. Edward Page of Hobart. Lansky's defense argued he didn't plan the killing. Authorities say Lansky told police he shot the longtime family friend at the attorney's home because he was upset over unfinished tax work. Page also had worked as Lake County Public Defender and served as a magistrate. A civil lawsuit is being filed by Page's husband, Kevin Swanson, over the death. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Indiana regulators have approved allowing the move of a casino from along Lake Michigan to an on-land location in Gary. The Indiana Gaming Commission's vote on Wednesday will let Indianapolis-based Spectacle Entertainment proceed with plans for building the new Hard Rock Casino on currently vacant land along Interstate 8094 with the aim of opening on December 31st, 2020. The action sets in motion state law provisions allowing a new casino in Terre Haute. Vigo County voters will decide in a November referendum whether to let that plan go forward. Spectacle and Full House Resorts, which owns the Rising Star Casino in southeastern Indiana, have expressed interest in building the Terre Haute Casino. Gaming Commission Director Sarah Gonzo Tate says no applications have been submitted yet. The deadline is December 1st. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Earlier this week, the board of directors who run the scandal-plagued Indiana Virtual School scheduled a public meeting to discuss its closure. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports what took place leaves more questions than answers.
Standing in the lobby of an Indianapolis business complex, the attorney for the Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Pathways Virtual Academy says there's no public meeting.
Two board members are here and resigned just a few minutes ago during the exam.
Mary Jean LaPointe says the board running the schools dissolved, and now no one remains, so the board is no longer responsible. Now former board member Tom Cretty says he had no choice but to resign, since Daleville Community Schools, the virtual school's oversight body, revoked their charters this week.
Deeply disappointed. We thought this was the wave of the future and a way of educating kids, and we believed in it.
Freddie says he has no role in the day-to-day operations, and he can't help students who want their transcripts. The state has asked the virtual schools to return $40 million after an audit found inflated enrollment. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. A primary provision of Indiana's 2017 anti-abortion law will remain blocked from taking effect after a federal appeals court's decision Tuesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports it's the 11th time in the last 3 years the state lost in court over an anti-abortion measure.
If a girl under age 18 in Indiana doesn't or can't get consent for an abortion from her parents, she can go to court to bypass that requirement. A 2017 state law said a judge will decide if the parents are informed of that hearing. Opponents of the measure argued that potential notification would scare girls off from trying to get an abortion. A federal district judge agreed. Now, so too does the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge David Hamilton writes, quote, "The state has not yet come forward with evidence showing that there is a problem for the new parental notice requirement to solve, let alone that the law would reasonably be expected to solve it. The state argued that parents need to know about the abortions to help care for their children, but Hamilton says that argument isn't supported by logic or evidence. The state can appeal the ruling." For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A summit in Indianapolis Wednesday focused on ways to reduce health inequity. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the event tackled social factors that influence health.
Health leaders, advocates, and policymakers from around the state attended the event that was a first for Health by Design, a coalition that works to create healthier places. Kim Irwin is the executive director.
Health outcomes, how long you live, how well you live, is directly tied to things that have nothing to do with doctor's offices and pharmaceuticals.
Those things include safe communities, transportation, and employment opportunities. Race and implicit bias also plays into health disparity, and that topic was top of mind at the summit. Keynote speaker Lily Farhang co-directs a California nonprofit that focuses on these issues and says events like these are a good first step.
It's just a willingness to engage in an honest conversation about what the roots of health inequities are.
About 200 people attended the event. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Sports wagering is officially ready to launch in Indiana on September 1st. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports the state's gaming commission unanimously adopted rules for the new betting system Wednesday.
Lawmakers legalized sports betting earlier this year, but that legislation doesn't take effect until September 1st. Gaming Commission Executive Director Sarah Tate says her staff has been working nonstop to get rules and procedures in place ahead of that date.
Staff believes we have created a regulatory scheme that ensures the integrity of sports wagering in Indiana.
But mobile sports betting won't begin September 1st.
We have not received a formal request to launch mobile from any operator yet. However, we have started receiving mobile-related materials and submissions.
Three Indiana casinos will offer sports betting on-site September 1st. Others will roll out later in September. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed hundreds in Indianapolis Tuesday at the American Legion National Convention. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenda Smith reports Pompeo's remarks touch briefly on current foreign policy hotspots like Iran, North Korea, and Afghanistan.
Secretary of State Pompeo's speech centered on Americanism, which the Legion lists as a core pillar. From Pompeo, that meant a political bent, focused on an America that, in his view, should be free from criticism.
So I'm honored to come before an audience that isn't going to get squeamish when I tell you that Americanism is something we must be proud of.
When it comes to current matters of state, Pompeo reserved the most time for Afghanistan. He acknowledged that some children now entering college weren't alive when the U.S. sent troops there.
We don't know how these efforts towards peace and reconciliation will end, but President Trump is committed to make sure that we get it right.
Vice President Mike Pence will address the convention Wednesday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
As officials look for ways to stem the opioid epidemic, a lot of effort has been put into limiting narcotic prescriptions. But new research suggests underlying social issues can lead to overdose deaths. Declining household income was the biggest driver of opioid deaths. But another substantial driver was prison and jail incarceration. Stephanie Whitesaid of Side Effects Public Media has more.
Nicholas Vincent is in prison in Southern Illinois for second-degree murder. He was 19 when he shot his victim. Vincent says back then he didn't think about life beyond alcohol, prescription pills, and crime.
I was just in a blur, you know, popping prescription pills, and I don't know, I was just blinded, like I didn't care about anything but partying and being in the streets and was never concerned about my future.
Now Vincent is preparing for life after prison. He's scheduled for release in January, but his background means that he's at risk for a deadly overdose. Mona Miller works at Centerstone, a behavioral health service provider. She says it's not uncommon for people to get off drugs while in prison because they have less access, but they may start using again when they get out.
Just because they may have had reduced access to drugs doesn't mean they're not still dealing with the addiction to them. And so when they come out, research has shown the first 2 weeks is there's a high overdose percentage within those first 2 weeks.
Angie Isaacs is a counselor with the Murfreesboro Reentry Center, where Vincent is incarcerated. The facility is one of four in the state with intensive training to prepare prisoners for life after release. She says losing the structure of prison can be a struggle for many people.
Because oftentimes, you know, if a guy goes out and he has nothing to do, well, when you have nothing to do, sometimes bad things happen.
People may also try to use the same amount of drugs they did before they went to prison, but they may not realize their tolerance has decreased. That can lead to accidental overdose. Dr. Lawrence King is a University of Massachusetts professor who has studied the connection between opioid deaths, incarceration, and economic decline. He says a lot of the attention is focused on other things, like suing drug companies for their role in the opioid crisis.
But that's only the supply of the drugs. It doesn't explain why people are doing them, you know. And that's kind of society. The opioid epidemic is really has social causes. It's not just exposure to opioids.
That doesn't mean letting drug companies off the hook, he says. But King thinks America also needs to address the social issues that lead to drug use. Miller notes that stress and trauma increase the odds of substance abuse.
Long-term poverty and lack of opportunities are quite stressful for people. And, you know, at times people develop negative coping skills, but it's survival skills. And so they do what they need to do to survive.
King says revitalizing the economy is one aspect to tackling the opioid crisis. That means not just jobs, but specific kinds of jobs.
Good wages, good benefits, and stability. Good union jobs. Those are the kind of jobs you want. You don't want crappy jobs without unions, for very low wages, without good benefits.
King also supports using prisons to help people get treatment for substance abuse disorders to reduce the risk they'll relapse when released. More than half of state prisoners meet the criteria for a drug use disorder, but most don't receive treatment while incarcerated. As Vincent's release nears, he's been taking classes on substance abuse and getting job training at the Murfreesboro Center. He's worried about his safety when he gets out, but it's not his biggest fear.
Honestly, I don't want to fail. That's what scares me the most about getting out. I don't want to fail. I don't want to screw up and have to come back here, you know. And I think for me, my only downfall would be if I drink that bottle again. That would be my number one ticket back to prison, you know.
Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A former bookkeeper and interim executive director of the Genesis Convention Center is being charged with one count of theft from a local government entity receiving federal funds for stealing more than $10,000 cash from the struggling business. Lakeshore Public Radio host Sharon Jackson spoke with Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson about the hiring of Victoria Wilson of Portage and the investigation of the irregularities that were showing up.
So I just wanted to get your response, just have a conversation with you real quick about what happened concerning Victoria Wilson, the former bookkeeper. What is your response to her, you know, having been charged with stealing from the Genesis Convention Center?
Well, I'm certainly not surprised at the outcome. We referred what we determined to be some irregularities at the Genesis Center to the State Board of Accounts. And we had done our internal investigation. There were dollars that we could not account for. As a result of that, we referred it to the State Board of Accounts. I shared it with the board, and they ended her employment there. And we were not surprised to learn that Victoria Wilson had been charged. I'm certainly disappointed in her actions, but when we noticed some irregularities at the Genesis Center, our internal auditor did an investigation, and we referred the results of that investigation to the State Board of Accounts. So this is just the logical progress of something that we observed ourselves. So we are pleased that the person who is responsible is being held accountable.
How did the city and the internal investigation track it back to Wilson?
Well, we weren't sure if it was Wilson, but we knew that as the bookkeeper, she had certain responsibilities in terms of depositing money, doing it in a timely manner. And we noticed that that was, in fact, not happening. And so when we observed that, then, you know, we started kind of going back and looking at the contracts to make sure that the money that was being received by the contractual obligations of the people who rented the Genesis Center, and, you know, and that all made it into the city's bank account. We started to backtrack to ensure that whatever a person agreed to pay, one, that they were paying it so that they had receipts for their payments, and two, when they paid it, it was properly receipted into the city's bank account.
So her last name is Wilson. She's not related to you in any way, is she?
Not at all. Didn't even know before she started working at the Genesis Center.
Oh, okay. How was she hired and who hired her?
There was an open call for resumes. She responded to that call and, you know, we all conducted interviews. Actually, I think that the board conducted bookkeeper interviews, and then when the person who was the director left, she was placed in that position on an interim basis because, of course, she was familiar with the process and familiar with the operations of the Genesis Center. But she responded to an open call for resumes.
When did the investigation, the internal investigation, happen?
Oh, that's been over, gosh, at least 2 years, I know.
So what is her plea agreement, do you know?
No, I don't know the details of the agreement. I do not.
She has to pay restitution, though, to the city?
I do know that restitution is one of the conditions.
Okay. Does she have to pay back all the money?
Yes.
Do you know if she's going to get any jail time?
That I do not know.
So what are you doing for a bookkeeper now at the Genesis Convention Center?
Oh, well, you know, she's been gone over 2 years, so there's been a person there for the last 2 years who, by all accounts, has done a great job.
Are you getting any criticism? Because I read in a news release that the board hired her and you picked the board. Are you getting any kind of criticism for that incident?
Well, I mean, you know, you, in any position, you think that you're hiring a person who has integrity, who is going to do a good job. Generally, people don't tell you they're stealing or that they're going to steal. And so, you know, I don't blame the board. I certainly would not say that, well, this is my fault because I chose the board. I mean, the board have proven to be a good group of individuals. They've kind of guided the Genesis Center into being much more profitable than it's been in the past. So I wouldn't, you know, people aren't always going to criticize you, but that's something that you can't necessarily take to heart.
Right. Are you kind of thick skinned now that you've been in working to serve the public for so long?
I wouldn't say that, but I understand that criticism comes with the territory. That's certainly the case.
Sure. So what is the city going to do from here on out to kind of ensure or try to ensure that nobody does anything like that again?
Well, we will do what we did that allowed us to detect the irregularities with Victoria, which is to continue to maintain our internal controls, to work to improve upon them, to make sure that every employee is clear and is trained and understands what they are. In fact, we just had a mandatory internal controls training earlier this month for all staff. So we will, you know, the city will continue to ensure that we are following the internal controls procedure.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Ridgely Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Northwest Indiana community activist Ruth Needleman.
Coming up on Thursday at 11:30 in the morning until about 1 is going to be a very special luncheon that's going to happen at the Avalon Manor, which is based in Hobart. Hobart or Merrillville, whichever, I think, depending on however you want to look at it. But it's there along US 30. And the folks from Northwest Indiana Forum are getting together with a lot of other members of the public and community leaders to celebrate a year of collaboration and transformation. And it's all about a big project that has been underway. And with us to talk about the project and about the luncheon coming up, too, we have Heather Ennis, who is the CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum. And Heather, thank you for stopping by the studios.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, this project is called, and I guess the luncheon is kind of that way, too, because it's all related. It's called Ignite the Region. Northwest Indiana Strategy for Economic Transformation. That's the name of the project, and it sounds like it has been, to say the least, a very ambitious project.
Absolutely. So we kicked off the plan a year ago. So we spent the year prior to that doing the planning and working with all of the regional stakeholders in order to craft this plan. And the really exciting thing about this plan is it's not a sit-on-the-shelf kind of plan. It is a plan that has action items and people meeting monthly, moving those action items along. So pretty exciting stuff.
How would you say it ranks with other probably similar discussions, maybe even plans that have been done up here in the region in the past?
You know, we really hadn't seen a full economic development strategy done previously that had an action item based to it. There have been a lot of studies done, but not an end. RDA has a strategic plan, and NERPC has a strategic plan, and Center of Workforce has a strategic plan. But really doing one full plan that incorporates all of those organizations and the parts that they play in economic development for the region really was kind of orchestrating the ballet, so to speak.
What seemed to be the incentive? Was it just a matter to bring all these individual plans together and create something that would be more region-wide, actually, rather than just by agency or organization?
Yes, and you know, as we've talked about previously, we were seeing declining populations. We were seeing declining per capita income in the region, and those statistics aren't one that we want to live with. So How do you turn that ship around? Well, you don't do it very well if you don't have a coordinated plan. And so really getting everybody on the same page, aligning what each organization is doing. There's a lot of great work being done throughout the region, but making sure that we're doing it in concert with one another is critically important. And so the Ignite umbrella brings together all of these regional organizations to talk about, okay, here are the things that one region is doing and being successful at and moving the ball forward on. Here are the things that Center of Workforce Innovations is doing. How do they align with one another? And how can we use economies of scale and better synergy in order to move the ball faster?
I know that from the information that's out there from the forum is that this plan is really kind of focusing on five specific areas, and they include business development and marketing, entrepreneurship and innovation, talent and placemaking, and infrastructure. And that's quite a bit when you take even just one of those. Like you say, you're talking about something, trying to judge what's been done or hasn't been done in the past and try to bring it to the future, isn't it?
Yeah, so really the best part of the plan is that it does cover so much space. Economic development isn't just solely about business attraction or solely about business retention and expansion. Talent plays such a critical point in trying to attract companies and trying to attract businesses to the region, trying to help the businesses that are here to grow and to be able to maintain their workforce or to educate their workforce for the jobs of tomorrow. So there's a lot of integral parts in an economic development plan and really being able to craft it all and roll it in together.
And I guess it is a pretty big plan because it is a pretty big topic to have have to take on. I know if you go on the Northwest Indiana Forum website and actually look at what's out there to see right now, I'm not going to print it out because it would be 92 pages.
And that's without the implementation matrix.
That's right. Yeah, there are more appendices and indexes to put in with that too. So it's a lot out there to be sure to be covering all of these topics. So how many people and how many organizations had to get together over the last year or so to help bring it to what will come out here eventually?
So when we first rolled the plan out, we met with about 500 different folks. We did 50 roundtable and one-on-one meetings talking with all different business sectors, manufacturing, government, entrepreneurs, innovators, healthcare. So we ran the gamut of the industries and sectors across the region, and educators and the like, and really trying to make sure that we covered all the bases from the stakeholder group. And then we sent out a public survey as well. So there were about 500 folks from the public that commented as well on what they wanted to see out of this plan. And as I said, we rolled this out last September. It's been a year in the making, and we've had a lot of activity around the implementation matrix and big ideas that are coming out mm-hmm. of this plan.
What are some of the things that members of the public have had to say, the ones that you've invited and the ones maybe have had an opportunity to put in their voice into what they know, at least during the process has been, what they like about it, what they'd like to see done here in Northwest Indiana to make it easier to bring new business and industry in, to keep people here in Northwest Indiana in the jobs and bring more jobs to Northwest Indiana and along all the other facets of this plan as well.
Yeah, people are really excited that we're working collaboratively. Obviously, you know, the forum is shepherding this project, but this is not the forum's project alone. So people are excited to see the region working collaboratively and to have more things done as a collective group and really being able to look at the long-term outlook for the region. There, you know, the people that have come to us have said how excited they are to see a well thought out plan of, hey, these are the next 5 years worth of steps that we need to take. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a living, breathing plan. We might look at some of these things tomorrow and say, okay, well, number two and number six under these under the business development and marketing strategy might not be applicable, or might need to have five additional steps done before we can get to that top step. So, you know, really it's a living, breathing document that we're celebrating this coming Thursday at the Avalon. So we're very excited about that luncheon and to be able to continue to roll out the success and the progress that's mm-hmm. being made around this plan. There are, you know, probably 50 to 75 folks in the region that are doggedly working on the progress of this, you know, 40 to 50 that are meeting on a monthly and quarterly basis just to make sure wow. that they're reporting and updating. Mm-hmm. But then all of the organization's time and energy that's being put into it as well. So it's pretty exciting.
For the session coming up here on Thursday, the luncheon that's going to be held at Avalon Manor, you mentioned there'll be a lot of people that are certainly going to be involved. It's not going to be like your typical meeting where you bring a bunch of people together for a meal and then an opportunity to kind of do a glossy overcovering of whatever is going to be presented. They get a chance to actually have had a chance in many cases, but participating and putting this thing together and have a chance to, I guess, talk more about it and find out more about it in detail.
Yeah, each of the pillars will be separated out around the room. And it's not a plated lunch. There'll be like luncheon stations around the room as well. So each of the sections will come and we'll be able to talk to, if your key interest is talent, you'll be able to talk to the folks that are working on talent and find out what strategies are happening under there and really figure out where, if you'd like to engage, how you could engage. And then business development and marketing will have its own pillar set up. And we will do a formal presentation where the whole room has the opportunity to hear about different things happening under these pillars, but each individual pillar will have its own station so people can dig into specifically what's of interest to them.
Now, are there still opportunities for folks that may want to attend the luncheon and catch all this information on Thursday?
Absolutely. So they can visit our website, which is www.nwiforum.org. And under our events section, you can just click on that and you can register there. So we're still taking registrants and would be happy to have anyone who wanted to come out.
Well, aside from this major project that you've all been spending a year plus in working on, the Ignite the Region plan, what else is the Northwest Indiana Forum been working on these days?
So, you know, it's so funny. We hosted 13 events last year in addition to the 50 roundtable meetings. We helped to attract $1.16 billion of investment to the region and over 1,800 committed jobs. We've got a lot of projects in the pipeline right now that we're working with the local economic development organizations and the municipalities to help bring to Northwest Indiana. And one of the things that the forum is specifically focused on is the business development and marketing component. So mm-hmm. there's we've been involved with scheduling and attending 20 outreach trips throughout the country this year, too, to go out and meet with companies and site selectors and brokers and tell them the story of Northwest Indiana.
Now, I wouldn't ask the question, although if you want to tell me, that's fine. We know that there's a company from the Bridgeport neighborhood in Chicago, which has taken over the space in what used to be the Lear Corporation plant in Hammond. They've moved into that facility and are starting up operation over time and going to add staff members. Are companies like that the ones that maybe that over time that you all go out and with others, and maybe certainly Mayor McDermott in Hammond and other people in the city of Hammond, but in a particular project, to attract, to get them to talk, look at Northwest Indiana in general and the cities in particular to show them how this might work for their particular business?
Absolutely. The tax climate in Indiana is ideal. And as you know, the climate in Illinois is rough. We do not want this to be a zero-sum game. You know, we thrive on the fact that we're our proximity to the city of Chicago and what that means to us. So we really appreciate that synergy. But our tax climate is such that businesses are going to be attracted to our area. And we do target market companies from the Illinois area. But we target market companies from all over the country as well. So we do have a list of target industries that we're going after. So trying to continue to build on the strengths of the region through the agri-value chain, through manufacturing, through logistics and transportation. You know, we've got an awful lot of resources here in the region. And so we're very excited about the opportunities that are wonderful tax climate office offers for us. But
are you getting some attention out of the folks in Indianapolis, in particular the lawmakers? Of course, the local lawmakers are more than involved in this, but do they get to pass the word on to their colleagues elsewhere? Or do the folks at the State House often check in to at least to see what's going on up here because of projects like Ignite the Region?
Yes, absolutely. And Kay Nelson and myself on our team at the forum are registered lobbyists. So we spend a decent amount of time downstate advocating for economic development mm-hmm. opportunities through the legislature. And we're very lucky to have a great legislative delegation up here in Northwest Indiana. I think the state is paying more and more attention to Northwest Indiana as we continue to get our house in order and continue to grow upon the successes that we've had previously. The state is recognizing that we mean business.
Did you have some opportunities in this past legislative session to get with lawmakers during the session and talk about some of these issues that we're bringing up now that's going to come up and maybe eventually in the overall plan?
Absolutely. And there's more items that are in the plan that will add to our legislative agenda for this year. So we had opportunity to work on the data center legislation last year. Also had the opportunity to work on the Economic Development Omnibus Bill with the IEDC and the Indiana Economic Development Association, which is all of our economic development peers across the state. So really great opportunities at the state level to be able to participate. I'm the vice chair of the Indiana Economic Development Association board and was their legislative chair last year. So mm-hmm. The more that we can be down at the State House speaking and put a Northwest Indiana face to these kind of issues, the more exciting it is for the region.
That's great to hear. Thank you very much for stopping in, Heather, and talk about not only the ambitious plan that is being worked on and coming up here with the presentation to all the people involved in the Ignite the Region luncheon coming up on Thursday, but in general, the efforts of the forum and all the other groups here in Northwest Indiana trying to doing to get more business and get the right kind of business for Northwest Indiana. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thanks again, Chris. We are really excited about the progress that we're making. They say, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. So we're excited to be helping with our other partners to move the ball forward on this project.
Heather, thank you for coming by. Appreciate your visit today and the information.
Thanks, Chris.
Heather Ennis is the CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.